Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking in urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, my guests are Dr. John Reeds. John is a senior lecturer in quantitative human geography at King's College London. My other guest is Martin Crookston. Martin is a strategic planning expert. And back in the day, in the late 1990s, he was on the Urban Task Force, which was chaired by Richard Rogers. And in some respects, was a kind of milestone in the re-emergence of the urban as being an important issue in national and local matters. So welcome to you both, Martin and John.
Thank you.
You are also the co-authors of a new book entitled, or the working title is, because it's to be published, Face to Face, Why Cities Still Matter in the Information Age. And that is going to be the content for our discussion today. And obviously, we are recording it in the midst of a crisis that directly challenges the ideas of proximity and face to face. So it's either a brave move to publish this or a completely daft one. Who knows? Maybe we'll find out. So with that context in mind, John, why don't you kick us off? And particularly, you start by really addressing this question. You have a kind of skeptical view of it, which is around, you know, people say, oh, no, this time is different. You know, death of distance, which has been much promised but little realised, is really here now. And it's all to do with ICT. You're skeptical of that assumption and that starting position. Just tell us a little bit about why, and then we'll get into the some of the more detail about the nature of face-to-face and why it endures.
You know, I think, you know, Martin and I, this is a conversation we've been having a lot, of course, since the book went in, the proposal went into the editor and the reviewer shortly before the outbreak of COVID-19. And I think a big part of it does boil down to face-to-face. It's why it's in the title, that it remains, as anybody who sat in on long Zoom meetings is gonna know, you know, genuine face-to-face remains one of the most effective ways to transfer a lot of complex information in an uncertain environment. So if you want to know if you can trust the people that you're going to be working with, you want to gauge how good an idea is, you know, understand how your pitch is going down with the, you know, with an audience, being face to face is such a richer environment. So it's not just about what you're saying. It's about, you know, you can see the person making notes furiously or, you know, checking Facebook and messaging, you know, messaging other people. So kind of at its root, it's about what we get from face-to-face. But one of the arguments that we make in the book is that, you know, academia tends to specialize a bit. So one person specializes on a particular industry, finance or consultancy or something like that. And so what you miss is that actually there's a distribution of dependencies. So our, you know, the point that we try to develop in the book is that when you're dealing in uncertain markets where there's a lot of overhead to developing and maintaining relationships with clients and things like that, that's where you're going to see pressure towards face-to-face because it helps us to resolve that uncertainty, to clear up misunderstandings quickly, to get everybody on board quickly. Where you're talking about standardized things, you know, buying books, you know, buying steel from China, you know, things like that, you can shift a lot more of that online. So what we would say is that, you know, face-to-face is important, but it's not the same importance everywhere to everyone. And that given the importance of essentially the knowledge industry to cities like London, New York, Paris, et cetera, we don't see the face-to-face interaction that drives and helps support the economies in these cities going away anytime soon, in spite of what we're going through right now.
Okay, that's helpful, Martin. Just add into that, but also, you know, just give us your reflections on, you know, what do the death of distance advocates miss? In a sense of, you know, they advocate for things can be done anywhere. We don't need to be near each other anymore. What are they missing in terms of being able to hold that position, given, you know, what John has just outlined?
What came out of the interviews that we did over the last couple of years, so before the pandemic, was that there are a number of strong reasons that people really think face-to-face is still important for, and in particular, I mean, there's a group. One lot, there's an enormous amount of internal meetings. As we say in the book, if the Russians wanted to invade London, they should choose 10 o'clock on a Monday morning because everybody's in a progress meeting. And so, you know, that's a large, people spend a very large amount of time actually in meetings, and a good chunk of those are internal. Then there's a sort of soft marketing stuff, not so much formal pitching, but people meet for quick, short checkups and meetings and coffees and so on. And it's part of the trust thing John was talking about, getting a feel for how people are reacting to you, keeping a project going informally. So there are all sorts of reasons why people still value it. And of course, as we see from rent levels in the City of London and Westminster, why companies will still pay for it. Because all those reasons are actually critical to the sorts of industries John talking about, where it's all about judgment. It's not about shifting steel from China.
But is it underpriced as a kind of asset in term by sort of ICT or technology advocates who essentially must be underpricing face to face relative to more kind of technological possibilities in dealing with some of those issues that you just outlined?
You could argue that. You could, I mean, because in a way, face to face has an incredible bandwidth. If you compare it with any of the modes that we are using electronically, digitally. And it's interesting you use the word underpriced. I think the effective price can be gauged by the rent, as I say, the rent levels in the high rent areas of central cities, not just London, Paris, New York, and so on, and who's in them. Who will pay these extraordinary rent? When you think, surely, to God's sake, insurance must be the easiest thing to do in the world. Why are you paying those rents in EC3? The answer is no, we want to be near each other because the margins are so fine and the trust confidence issues are so crucial that we'll pay these eye-watering rents to stay in that tiny little bit of the city.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's a point that is really often missed in these kind of conversations, that, you know, people go, well, you know, why didn't you come here, or look at the prices there, and they don't really fully understand or appreciate what the price is a signal for, you know, for something. So John, just come back to you on that, because you're very clearly setting out in the early parts of the book, at least, that, you know, face-to-face is more important for certain types of activities, and therefore firms and workers are prepared to pay a higher price to get that face-to-face. Can you just say a little bit about the sort of criteria that we should be looking for or thinking about in terms of where we would expect face-to-face to be most valued?
So we come back to this idea of uncertainty a lot. So, and I think building on what Martin had just said about insurance, I mean, when we talk about insurance being an EC3, we're not talking about selling policies to, you know, residential homeowners. What we're talking about is the specialist stuff, you know, the Lloyds, the reinsurance, the big, you know, the people who are, in a sense, developing, you know, industry scale policies and things like that. So, and at those sorts of deals, or the kinds of deals that a hedge fund might make or a bank might make, you know, you're going to have the IT people, the lawyers, the consultants. You know, they all need to be around the table, because it's not just, you know, we can agree things over a drink, as you famously apparently used to be able to do in the City of London. You know, there's so much complexity there, and the risks are so high that you really want to have those people around the table so that you build the trust. But you also have the free kind of information flow that you just don't get when people are, you know, FaceTiming, Zooming, et cetera. So, you know, one person checking their email, so they miss kind of a crucial point, or there's a misunderstanding about what a particular term means. So I'd say that's the kind of the piece of it. It's been more generically called knowledge work, but I think you have to distinguish between, for instance, you know, I used to work in the IT industry, and I have a lot of friends who, you know, who've worked for different IT companies. and they're much more willing to do everything remotely. But we still have ways of trying to, you know, meet up at conferences or other events, drop by for a drink. And it's because if you're a software developer, you can kind of gauge the capability of other people through kind of really effective indirect measures, like their contributions to open source libraries, you know, the kind of code commits they do, how they help you debug things. So we've got very sort of, in a sense, tangible, even though it's done in code, tangible ways of measuring and assessing other people. Whereas if you're looking at a legal document, it's, you know, that's a whole different order of magnitude of complexity. And I think when that comes into play, you want people in, you know, you want people together, you know, staring at each other across a, you know, across a boardroom table or something like that.
That's why, in a sense, it's not so much about trust, and it's a word we use as a shorthand. It's actually about confidence in other people's judgment, to which you really got to be up close to form the view from all the cues that you possibly can. You know, do these people understand the unwritten rules laid down by convention, and as well as the written rules that regulators lay down? And it's this business of the sort of norms of competitive and collaborative behavior that are expressed by a variety of cues when you're in a face-to-face setting, which you're not going to pick up, or only very partially, even in a Zoom meeting where everybody's on the screen, because there's no just out of vision stuff going on. And I think that was really interesting talking to the finance players in particular. I think the guy who was just back from Ankara from a really complicated reinsurance deal in the minerals industry in Turkey. You know, there were millions riding on what you judged about these people's technical ability and also their ability to judge other people in the session. There's a sort of layered business there of trusting people who trust others who you're relying on secondhand and so on. So, and all that is so much more capable of being expressed and understood in a face-to-face setting.
Yeah. And just to round this bit of the conversation off, get both your reflections on it. So I'm just so we're clear and listeners, we're not saying, neither of you are saying, and in fact, we wouldn't say at the Center for Cities that, you know, technology hasn't changed and affected the way that work is undertaken, economic activity is organized. But in a sense, you need to think about technology as a complement to proximity and face-to-face rather than a substitute, to use that kind of jargon. John, is that would you concur with that?
I would say in a sense, yes, on both. It is a complement and a substitute. So it in a sense that it enables us to maintain larger personal and professional networks than we could, you know, even 20 years ago. And we can, in a sense, keep warm those contacts in a way that we couldn't if you had to sit down and, you know, write a letter or send a telegram. So in that sense, what's happening is face-to-face is attached ever more to kind of the most important relationships or the most important phase of a relationship. So, you know, it's a new, you know, a potential new client. You're going to go and meet them face-to-face because you want to gauge them, understand their needs, who are they, et cetera. If it's somebody you've been working with for 20 years, then it's a lot easier to kind of keep things ticking over electronically and then use the face-to-face as a social kind of touching base, anything else on your radar. You know, that kind of informality of face-to-face paradoxically is what makes it so powerful that when combined with that information density.
Give us a thought you're thinking on, you know, how we then move from thinking about face-to-face, I suppose, within the firm, you know, within individual firms, which obviously in part that was the origin of why firms came into being, to reduce the transaction costs of interaction in some respects, to better organize labor, et cetera, et cetera. But actually how we move from thinking about firms and how they're organized to actually thinking about why then cities become, you know, the dominant spatial scale at which the face-to-face economy is organized. Just say something about that.
It's to do with how often, not you, that you do meet people, but you might need to meet people. I mean, in PR and advertising and journalism and property, you get this daily stream of meetings and short conversations and presentations and functions and sort of people. It's a sort of promiscuous set of industries that where they're in the swim all the time. But one of the venture capitalists we interviewed, he described touching the investment quite frequently, and it turned out he meant every few weeks. So, I mean, it's horses for courses there. But I think the reason for choosing a central place is not to, to do how off with how often the face-to-face contact actually takes place, but as I said, how often it might take place. You've got to be available at any time. It's not that you want to be in meetings all the time. And so central cities are places where you can be on call at all times. You can whiz around, you can go and see somebody when the thing's hot. And that's what I think it's offering more and more. As John has said, stuff is offloaded to digital mode as often as we can do it. I mean, we all do it. If you don't have to rely on face-to-face, then you're probably going to send an email and so on. So I think that there is very definitely an essential element here of people co-locating because they need to be near other people in case they need to see them. That's almost at the core of it.
Yes. And, you know, as we, John, as we often say at the centre of a city, again, which is an obvious thing, but, you know, the economy is not evenly or randomly distributed across space. You know, there are very clear reasons why we see some stuff in some places and other stuff in other places. You know, and so just say a little bit about, you know, that the distribution of economic activity, and you know, what are the kind of criteria that firms and workers are considering, and the trade-offs they're making between costs and benefits in relation to different locations?
Yeah, so we link in the book a lot of that back to ideas about infrastructure. So if you work for a US tech firm, you know, headquartered in Silicon Valley, then chances are you've got a lot of, obviously you've got a lot of online interaction with them, but you will also have meetings, people flying in to meet with you or you having to fly over there to meet with them. And so being near Heathrow, although presumably not under its flight path, if you can manage that, is going to be an attractive place to be. Whereas if you're involved in, say, back office of the banking sector, then you know, those people are not having, on the whole, meetings with the same regularity. So you will pick an office location that is a bit cheaper than the center city. Also, your staff might like that because it means that they can have a place in, you know, further out in the country rather than having to make the kinds of trade-offs that we do when we live in, you know, London proper. So you get, again, it's about both firms and people trying to arbitrage between these different infrastructures, how often they might need them, how dependent they are on them. So we kind of see it almost as an accessibility surface, I guess you could say, where people will prioritize what's most important to them and the kinds of contact patterns that they have to sustain. And I think the thing that, so the mistake, one of the mistakes that the people who have claimed, you know, with technology, we'll all go live in the countryside have made is that, in a sense, by being omnipresent, ICT takes itself out of the picture completely. So if I don't have to worry about accessing, you know, broadband, then I don't, you know, that's just not part of my decision matrix, if you will. Although that does mean, and I think looking ahead a little bit to some of the conversation around the pandemic and its sort of potential impact on London, I have a family who live up in Scotland. Every time I go up there, I think, God, I love Scotland. I'd love to be up here. Of all the family that I go to visit, only one of them has broadband on which I can download, you know, an operating system update in less than 6 hours. So, you know, the idea that I could somehow sustain these kinds of interactions, the sort of, you know, both online and offline, living in rural, you know, rural Scotland just isn't going to fly.
Of course, and we're saying that it varies industry by industry and so on. But of course, the technology's varying is a variable surface as well, not just in terms of that sort of access that John's talking about, but sudden breakthroughs in technology, such as artificial intelligence, or people's reaction and exploiting of the potential that the technology has. We were very interested that we think we've discovered that far less recruitment now is done by face-to-face chatting, even people getting informal job leads and so on, face-to-face. It's done by electronically, by digital means. People are just using Facebook and all the other social media to exchange information about that kind of thing in a way that was inconceivable 10 years ago, and which I think was not foreseen. People thought that, oh, that kind of thing will carry on forever. So it's a brave person who says that any of it is robust to the threat of IT moving it, giving it more freedom of choice. But at its core, we think that the things that face-to-face can offer are robust to that and will carry on reinforcing central place strength.
Yes, and it's, and as always, it's, you know, it's at a certain price point, right? I mean, that's the point that people miss. It's not that, as you say, it's not that these the relative value of face-to-face versus online is always going to be evolving and changing, and it will matter to different firms at different price points. Some will continue to play and want to be in the central business district, you know, for the foreseeable future until prices reach a certain point, and they may then make ultimate, you know, a different decision. But and so understanding the trade-off is really critical, John.
Yes, I agree. I agree with you completely, and that it's that it, you know, technology helps that line move in the same, you know, it moves it up, if you will. So the value that we attach to face to face has to become even higher because we can do some substitution. But the you know, and what's happening with the situation that we're in now with the pandemic is that we're, you know, that line has been forced to move, but the idea, and it's never going to go back to where it was in January 2020, but it's also not that this is going to become the new normal, because we're now missing, you know, we've had to go in order, you know, to protect people. We've had to go so far down the other end of everything's being done electronically that people, and Martin might be able to speak to this a little bit more because he's kind of collected our follow-on interviews. You know, people are now realizing what it is that they miss and what it is that they would be willing to pay for in terms of having access to, you know, real face-to-face interaction.
Yeah, that's a great point. I, you know, a lot of the stuff I read is, you know, people talking about, well, we, you know, we can all work from home now. It's you know, all this will just hasten, you know, the shift, you know, from working from home. One of my responses, actually, I think the experience of working from home brings into sharper aspect what is good about it, and indeed is what's not, and actually reminds us about what face-to-face offers in terms, you know, it can often be taken for granted. It's a, you know, it's a good point. I think it's not just a one-way move, I think, in some respect. Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, two things. One is the whole question of, will it stick? Is this a permanent change? One of our interviewers, a university academic, said, I bloody well hope not. That was one line of his response. But I think that there is the general point, isn't there, that one ought to always be suspicious of initial reactions as being much of a guide. I mean, I think General Haig is supposed to have observed during the First World War, the news from the front is never as bad, never as good as it is first reported. And I think that's right. I mean, people immediately get very excited about the latest thing. And society is very, there's a lot of entropy. We're very conservative. And it will be pretty easy to drop back into pre-existing patterns. And then the other thing I would say, that in terms of the policy responses, you might cynically compare with the Grenfell Tower tragedy. If you remember in 2017, nothing will ever be the same again in the housing system. Well, it bloody well is. I mean, so you know, there's a huge amount of entropy, and I wouldn't minimise for a moment the prospect of most things dropping back to quite like they were before. Yeah. But on the point of what people said they were missing, I think the first thing is at least half of them said that working from home was already a big part of their modus operandi. And this was people across a dozen sectors of the economy. So this wasn't just academics or market researchers or anybody. But what they said they missed was, first of all, the quality of interaction. They said, a market researcher actually, she said, face-to-face is vastly superior, deeper and more nuanced. Of course, I'm hopelessly biased, but it was a common flavour of a response. They all said that, which is reinforcing the sorts of things that John's already said and that we say in the book about... but they said they were missing it. They said they were missing social interaction. One regeneration practitioner said to me, well, ours is a relationship business. Of course we're missing it. And it seemed to mean the three things that we've sort of touched on. You can't develop relationships. You can maintain a relationship on Skype, but it doesn't get richer in a sort of human sense. And so new client production is an incredible struggle. My insurance broker guy said, you know, building trust can't be done over the phone. Building trust requires face-to-face contact, pure and simple. And so... incidentally, therefore, it removes that key advantage of central city location. You know, that the reason you're prepared to pay for that is because that is how you get your new work. But you can't do it at the minute. The system's broken to that extent, and people are really missing it. And then, of course, there's the internal stuff, which I've mentioned. But, you know, coffee break chat, the one-to-one in breaks in meetings, which you can't do in Zoom, but... they're actually quite an important part of how an office keeps running smoothly, all that stuff, whether internally or the relationships. You know, there was a developer said to me, well, you often need to nobble people in a corridor. Well, if there's no corridor, you can't nobble them. And so the people, these are people who've responded since the lockdown, and they were identifying very clearly what the loss of face-to-face means for them and for central London businesses, I think.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I mean, you know, I think under two aspects, underappreciated, get your thoughts on it. You know, one, as you say there, Martin, is the sort of the informal, unstructured, impromptu interactions where, you know, they aren't part of any formal gathering. It just literally just happens. And it happens either in, you know, within a workspace or indeed between workspaces in public or communal spaces, often when we least expect it. So that's kind of one thing. And then the second thing is, which you'd be interested to get your thoughts on, and how strong this came out in the, you know, in the interviews that you were doing, in the conversations, was the social aspects of, you know, of working in an office or working in a particular place, which is actually, you know, the social returns that we get as individuals, irrespective of the workplace returns, just in being around other people and actually enjoying at a social level the interactions, which again, you know, we can't get. You know, how many times people say, I actually enjoy working with my colleagues. I actually enjoy spending time with my colleagues. This is not just work to me. This is this is part of my and way of life. John, are you, your thoughts on that?
Face-to-face is valuable around the non-routine, right? And so the maintaining and deepening relationships as Martin referred to. And that's everything that's kind of built around built around the meeting, or as you were saying, kind of in the interstices between meetings. And, you know, I was just thinking, this popped into my head while Martin was talking, is the idea of, you know, you want to have a quiet word with somebody. Look, I've heard a few, I've had a few complaints that you're a bit like a bull in a china shop on these calls. You know, how do you have that? Because if you have to put it in an email, you're going to handle it in a completely different way. And so we are, if you will, social animals of a sort, and we get a creative bump from being with other people, when it's not a kind of an all day meeting. But I wrote down at one point while I was preparing for our chat, you know, that we're all academics now in a sense. So it's not often that we get to position academia as being at the forefront of employment practices. But the fact is that most academics work, say, 2 to 3 days in the office and 2 to 3 days at home, more from home when they can manage it outside of term time, you know, less when they have teaching obligations. And so we've always had a degree of flexibility there. And so for me, working from home should be, well, this is what I do all the time. This is fantastic. Now I have to do it. But in fact, what I realized was that my working from home actually involved, you know, going to a coffee shop, sitting around other people who weren't going to talk to me and try and rope me into meetings. But there was that buzz, there was that kind of stimulation of being able to look up and kind of catch a vibe, if you will. So it wasn't a co-working space, but it was a, you know, kind of your average London coffee shop slash bakery with a co-working space attached. It's quite funny because Martin ended up having so many meetings there that I think he'd started talking about it as creative center of London. And this was a, you know, a small space in Walthamstow. And so we get so much from that social interaction, from being around people being social, that suddenly being confined to the house feels, you know, does feel like prison. And I think if we were looking ahead to kind of the sort of potential impacts that this is going to have, I mean, one thing we need to think about is the kind of built environment that we're producing for younger people in London. Because of course, who are the people being criticized in the, you know, in the press? It's, oh, all those people who are out in the parks not observing social distancing. Well, if all they've got is a, you know, is a bed sit or a, you know, one bed flat, I mean, that's, you know, I think we do need, there are things that are going to need to change, but our need for human interaction as a component of our day-to-day interaction is not going to change.
Absolutely. No, it's a great point. If you, some of the work that we've done, if you, you know, just take London as an example, in London, you are most likely to not have access to your own open space, private space, whether it's a garden or balcony or whatever it is. But you're also most likely to be within about 500 meters of a public open space. And I think there's an interesting sort of conversation and policy issue around, you know, private space on the one hand, gardens, etc., and, you know, the value of public space in particularly high density places like London, where, you know, open space becomes much more valuable. Martin, I want to, and we talked a little bit about it, but let's get to how is this all going to change? I mean, you were in the book, in a sense, you talk about, you know, some of the bigger macro technological ways of working trends that are likely to, you know, to affect what gets done in cities, on particularly in the core of cities, and what doesn't. And obviously now we've got, you know, a pandemic, which is, you know, currently essentially one all about social distancing, you know, staying away in many respects from the very core. So just start to lay out your thinking around how this face-to-face value changes, what's going to change it. And then we'll look at some of the examples that you talk about in the book, ranging from Shrewsbury, which, you know, Middle England kind of market town, London, global city, and then obviously some of the northwestern towns, which were, you know, were essentially industrial, and that's what their origin. So just paint a picture for us about some of these trends that are going to affect it, and then we'll get into these places.
Sure. I mean, the first thing to say is, I think the one of the things that seems to be coming out of what we're being told from our follow-ups to the interviews about the effect of the pandemic is on property. Several people said things like, one of the people in the finance sector in the city, square footage costs in prime location would be reviewed and reduced. He was quite plain about it. Advertising agency guy said, the working for home experience is revealing to many agencies they're torching money on property and workspace that isn't necessary. A developer said, the office sector already looked at a pretty bleak future in our view, and I certainly wouldn't ever build office space again. So there's going to be a really hard look at that sector, and I think we're flatlining is the best you can expect in the total stock. It's a question of how much new, how much replacement, how much gets changed. The other thing is, what's going to happen to co-working space? I mean, short term, it's going to be hellish difficult to use it with social distancing. But one developer in that sector, not WeWork, was obviously feeling exposed. He said, it's made us realize that we're paying for, made our clients realize they're paying for something they don't need, because they've had remote working reinforced for them so strongly. So although some commentators have suggested that post-lockdown co-working will be stronger, I have my doubts both short-term and longer-term. I mean, that's one area. Then thinking about the things, the sort of longer-term non-pandemic perspective, we were very interested in the artificial intelligence debate, because that's one, as you know, that we talk about in the book, and where there are some very, very excitable forecasts of, you know, it's the end of work as we know it sort of thing. And we looked at law, for example, and in law, we were told that certain parts of the legal practice that where, you know, you're closing a contract and you need to do due diligence, pretty soon that is currently employing, let's say, 15 or 20 young lawyers, all paid about $100,000 a year, hurled at it for 18 hours a day for a couple of weeks. Most of that will go to AI in the next few years, and a few very senior lawyers will interrogate the top end of the output for the conclusions. The person I interviewed said, it's all right, they're young, they're bright, they'll get new work. The young lawyers, she meant. But that's clearly a big, big change instigated by a particular new technology. But if there's one thing that we've learned and that we keep on picking up on in the book, is that, you know, at the minute, London has exported an enormous number of jobs of the sort we've been talking about. And that AI stuff will be the same sort of thing. They either go completely or they're exported to a cheaper location. But London has carried on, central London has carried on replacing those jobs with new stuff to an extraordinary extent. So it is now more dominant in the greater London economy than it was 20, 30 years ago.
Yep.
And so you've got to be very, very confident that any one or any group of these technical changes is so important to turn around a trend like that. So I think we're pretty confident that there isn't going to be a technical solvent, is it you call it, that sort of removes all that place advantage. But you do have to be careful, because I was working on Crossrail and Jubilee Line in the early 90s, late 80s, and the story then was London was doomed. Look at the trend. Down for year after year since 1957 or whatever it was. And it was one of the minor reasons, apart from politics, why Crossrail didn't get the go-ahead all those years ago. And so you can take a long-term trend and assume it's ineluctable, it's going to go on forever, and it doesn't. So we're not saying that it's impossible that these trends will change, but I think we argue ourselves to a position in the book where we're saying there is a huge amount of evidence here from how infrastructure delivers an uneven surface of advantage, how markets actually work, how people price risk, why therefore face-to-face matters, that tells us that even if new technologies, as they will, keep on biting away at those advantages, underlying it are key assets that will not disappear.
John, just have your thoughts on, because Martin was saying, which I've heard a lot, you know, firms saying, do we really need this office space? It's very expensive. We can work from home, or we can, you know, different forms of working, which is obviously has an implication for real estate in our urban cores. But does that mean that real estate changes, or does that undermine the actual notion of being in the city itself? Or will the being in the core still remain, still be valuable? It's just that the office within the core becomes less relevant or less important. I mean, what will be the future employment spaces if they're not co-working or if they're not offices?
Well, I think I was at the launch of was the report on headquarters. London headquarters. I can't quite remember what it was called, but the talking about different forms of headquarters, and one of them was kind of the sliver HQ, where there was just a small part of the head office, of the traditional head office, was kept in central London, and so I think what you were talking about in terms of a weakening or a stability within the central London area, and increased interest in spaces that are, in a sense, more social. And the funny thing is it's very easy to start with Ken Cross's, you know, The Death of Distance and think that's about flattening out everything. But in fact, what's in the book, and Martin might want to correct me because it's been a while since I've reread it, but, you know, they say a lot in there about, well, actually, this is going to be about cities becoming centers of, you know, leisure and being social. And I think that's already, in a sense, where we're headed. But that socialization, the sociability is part of work, especially if you're in, you know, one of the knowledge intensive sectors. I think that's right, John.
Yeah. I mean, I think what very clearly came out of both our round of interviews and of the most recent follow-ups we did is that the spaces required a shifting in the mountain type, not just more and more offices where we work and hold meetings, but spaces where we can get on with work when we need to, in between the other spaces where we're meeting up in kind of all sorts of formats and settings. And, you know, that's people you get the buzz of central London and being there. It really matters to them. And they use an incredible range of spaces, you know, neutral places like hotel lobbies, people were meeting in co-working spaces, obviously, cafe restaurants that weren't noisy. But they're where you have these kind of not random and not quite by accident either meetings that are part of being in the city centre. And I think that's connected to the point you've both just been making, that the social and the work environment are tending to overlap more. Although people aren't using their social life to be work, they're working in more social ways, curiously.
Yes. No, absolutely. Right. So we've talked a little bit about some of the implications for London. In the book, you also reference a couple of other places. So I just want you to share your thoughts. The place you choose as a symbol, really, an example of a broader set of places is Shrewsbury. Just tell us a little bit about how you think some of the trends that you outline in the book and obviously the conversations you've been having subsequent, how a place like Shrewsbury is going to be affected and how it might need to respond.
I think I'll do it because I've been to Shrewsbury and I bet John hasn't.
Not recently.
I mean, I think we were sort of edging towards providing not exactly policy pointers, but ways of thinking that would apply to places like that. Sort of trying to say to him, don't think that because digital is getting more and more important that you can attract firms to you that used to be in big cities and so on. That isn't how it works. What you've got to do is decide how you can be the central place for your catchment, which in the case of a market town like Shrewsbury is a sizable chunk of their county of Shropshire and the surrounding area. What is it you can still offer to that catchment? What has your town got that enables it to do the small scale version of all the central place stuff we've been talking about for central London? And don't go, you know, don't go wasting money and space on things that are not going to have a future. You know, do you really need more out of town shopping in or edge of town shopping or edge of town business parks in an environment where people can do so much more online that those environments are falling between the advantages of the centre of Shrewsbury, the social interaction and so on, and the ease of clicking a button and having something delivered. What we've been trying to do for those places, and as you say, particularly for Shrewsbury, was to say, let's have a look at the local economy and see what it can do. And it turns out that it can do what it's been doing for the last 1,000 years. You know, be the market town, the central place, the meeting place, the forum for Shropshire, and not get carried away with visions of becoming a new boom town of any sort. And then what we then also looked at was, it was actually three towns up the West Coast Main Line in the M6, Wigan, Preston and Carlisle. And and their futures are sort of in the reverse order of confidence, we think, because Carlyle, the story, is pretty much the same sort of thing as Shrewsbury, though it's bigger and has more sunk investment in industry and that kind of stuff. Preston, similarly, is quite dominant in its sub-region, although more constrained by competing towns. And then Wigan, which is an old market town, actually, but has a long history of the last 200 years of being an industrial town, really has to work out how it can be a useful place in the Greater Manchester constellation. You know, what is its relationship to be to Manchester and to a lesser extent Liverpool? Can it make itself attractive enough to businesses and to commuters that it still has a role in a world where if all it does is allow what they've been tempted to do, which is people to build warehouses by the M6 junctions, in which you'll get 10 or 15 jobs and probably fewer in 10 years' time. That is not a strategy. That's just a reaction to developers coming through the door. And so it was trying to get people to suggest ways in which people could think about what might be the advantages and disadvantages of a location like that. And that it isn't very often going to be cheap labour or cheap land, because almost anybody can beat Britain at that game.
And I mean, to both of you again, I think a lot of the similarities in what you've just said, Martin, in the work that we do about trying to understand where you are, particularly in a kind of more than local context, and understanding what your contribution is relative to the places that are around you, whether you're the hub, as in Shrewsbury, of a kind of largely rural economy, or if you're somewhere like Wigan that is on the within a city region context in relation to Greater Manchester. It's always interesting, I think. I don't know what your reaction is to the degree to which places are amenable to and engaged in that kind of thinking, rather than always seeing themselves at the centre of something and wanting everything else to work around them.
Yes, I mean, I was interested in West Yorkshire, which we don't touch on in the book, but where I had done some work, and where Leeds and Bradford a generation ago were pretty well on a par, but Bradford then went through a rough patch, and Leeds was surprisingly successful. And the West Yorkshire towns have sort of come to a kind of peace treaty about which leaves Leeds up in pole position as the centre of the region. Bradford has other things it does, and it's still a big city. Halifax and Huddersfield do other different bits of stuff, and they could do more than that, because still, you think, why are Leeds still allowing sort of employment land that's basically car-borne and lorry-borne at the top end of the M1, when Barnsley can do that job within the region? So they've not actually worked it all out as a regional strategy, but there is a sort of tacit understanding that they're all doing slightly different things, and that they'll be better off if they don't all compete for the same things. You don't see that in all the other regions, I don't think, unless you've got one dominant place, and I thought the interesting thing about West York is that Leeds wasn't, in the same way that, say, Manchester is over its ring of old cotton towns and so on.
Yeah, no, it's a very good point.
I suppose Newcastle Sunderland's the same story, that Sunderland sort of pulls a miserable face and doesn't want to be number two, even though it is, to Newcastle Gateshead.
Yeah, no, I agree. John, and we sort of bring into a kind of wind to a close, but I mean, your thoughts on, given you were, you've thought about this and you've been working in this sort of space for a long time before the pandemic came along, but it does take us back a little bit to, days of yore and centuries past, where, cities were often at the mercy of contagious diseases. Has the pandemic changed your mind on anything, in terms of the value of face-to-face and how it might evolve and over the next decade or so?
I would assume that people are going to be more selective about when they choose to meet up. I mean, the lockdown, one hopes, is not going to last forever. And so, you know, I think clearly there will be for the foreseeable future less business travel, especially less international travel, because who wants to get stuck in a country that's just going into or coming out of lockdown? Commuting is probably reduced for good to some extent, although, you know, we're very much creatures of habit. So, you know, if it's kind of business as normal fairly soon, we'll probably go back to doing things largely how we were, but, you know, lower flows than before. Clearly, some people are thinking a bit more about work-life balance, things like that. And that is creating some interest in getting out of London. So I think, you know, London was a kind of Faustian bargain that young people were willing to make for quite a long time. I think for some percentage of people, that, you know, the side that you come down on is going to change. There was a nice bit of product placement for Rightmove in The Guardian recently about how interest has shot up in kind of towns. You know, that were initially described in the Guardian article as being in the country, but when you actually kind of read through it, it was saying, oh, these are all places with good rail links into London. So I think one of the paradoxical kind of consequences that we could be looking at is actually the London sort of employment zone, London's influence is actually extended by the pandemic, because, you know, people are in a sense socially distancing on one level, but actually still within the London, you know, within the London orbit. So, and that's something that more homeworking would support, because a 1.5 hour commute each way is not something you would do 5 days a week if you had any choice in the matter. But if you only have to do it 2 days a week, then suddenly, you know, it starts to look quite bearable. So, you know, within, in some ways, this might reinforce Britain's core cities by, you know, encouraging people to move out but still remain connected via technology, with then the travel supporting that face to face, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does perfectly. I have very similar views on how it might affect the location decisions of people as to where they live relative to where they work. Martin, kind of same question, I suppose, you know, and final reflection from you. In what way is the, you know, has the pandemic and the experience of it changed your view on how these, you know, the enduring nature of our cities and faces, or at least over the next 5 to 10 years? I mean, after that, who knows, right?
Yeah, no, I think it hasn't. I mean, I'm old and cynical. So I think, as we've agreed, the world of work will change as a result. And we talked about accelerating and strengthening already visible trends. I think that's true. And better technology to support remote working will undoubtedly follow in its train. But basically, I think these are effects that work around the margins of the core advantages that cities have, you know, the convenience, the adaptability, and the personal interaction that you get with face-to-face. So in a sense, I suppose I'm saying, let's not get carried away.
Very good. That's a good note to finish on. We've been talking, obviously, about your book, Face-to-Face, Why Cities Still Matter in the Information Age. John, when will everyone else get to read it? When is it going to be published?
Well, the editor that we've been working with is clearly keen for this to come out as soon as possible. We need to rewrite our introduction and conclusion to take into account events since January. As soon as possible would be the answer. I'm guessing
later this year, didn't they?
By the end of this year is what we've been told is our target. So.
Well, we will keep an eye on it for it, and we'll put a link up to it. And so when it becomes active, people can consume it. But if not, obviously they can listen to the podcast and get a flavour as to what the book will entail. My guests today have been Martin Crookston and John Reeds. Martin and John, thanks for being part of City Talks.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. With any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.